Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to How Should I Be Positioned on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. As you know, on this podcast, we do like to catch up with our industry colleagues and partners to discuss the market and macro environment, along with thinking when it comes to asset allocation. So joining us once again for the conversation from the UBS Chief Investment Office, glad to welcome back the Head of Asset Allocation for the Americas, Jason Dreho. We're also excited to welcome back to How Should I Be Positioned, Jeffrey Sherman, the Deputy Chief Investment Officer and Portfolio Manager with Double Line Capital. So with that, Jason, Jeff, it's great to be back with you both. I know there's a lot to catch up on in consideration of the market environment we've experienced over the past few days to a week. So thank you both for spending some time with our listeners, our clients, and very much looking forward to hearing your thinking.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you, Jeff. It's a kind of perfect time given all the volatility in the marketplace.
And as we're recording here, it's Tuesday, August 6th. I know we're coming off of a couple consecutive sessions of sharp selling pressure. Jeff, I'm curious from your vantage point at Double Line, what might be some of the key indicators, drivers of this market behavior, and what's really indicative of this move?
Yeah, I think as we step back and kind of reassess the landscape, what you've had is a bond market that's been begging for cuts from the Fed for, I'd say, at least dating back to November of last year when Jay Powell tipped his hand and said the hiking cycle is effectively over. The next move is probably down. And so if you recall, at the beginning of the year, we had as many as seven cuts priced into the marketplace this year on the 25 basis points magnitude. So call it almost a cut every meeting was effectively priced in for 175 for the year. And thus far, we have zero cuts to date. But Jay kind of tipped his hand at the last meeting saying inflation seems to be on its path. He didn't want to commit to September being where they start the cutting cycle, but it was definitely talked about, and he alluded to it in the press conference. And so this kind of catalyzed a little bit of the bond rally that started. But then the jobs report on Friday just really was something that the market interpreted as being extremely weak. And in any other environment, creating, you know, on the magnitude of 140,000 jobs wouldn't be a horrible kind of market or recessionary indicator. But for some reason, it really got the bond market going. And so was it short covering of people thinking that the Fed is going to be higher for longer? That's hard to really to tease out of the data, but it definitely took rates down, and there became this fear in the equity market that maybe the bond market knows something. And then you had the pile on, you know, over the weekend when Japan opened overnight or opened at nighttime here in Los Angeles, that you started to see massive selling pressure. You saw the yen carry trade unwind. And those things happen. And so we came to the office yesterday early in the morning. You had a really painful kind of bond rally again. I mean, a painful stock sell on bond rally. And there was some saving grace in the ISM services data when that report came out. Headline number was okay. The employment picture was much stronger, kind of offset some of those fears from Friday that there's a meltdown and collapse in the labor market. Which, again, remember, jobs are created, not lost last month, according to the headline, you know, non-farm payrolls. But as you look through it, we've got a little bit more stability out there. Yeah, bonds are a little bit well bid today, you know, after what we saw the last couple of days. But in general, it feels like the market is stabilizing a little bit. So I think one of the reprieves you get right now as we look for direction in the market is that there's not a lot of U.S. economic data coming out this week. And so I think this will let cooler heads prevail. We'll find kind of our levels. But right now you have a nervous market out there because I think it's all getting inferred from the overall bond market. And so but let me pause with that. I'm sure Jason has some comments too as it relates to equities and the like. But I want to just start there and just say that I think it's the rates that are spooking everyone by rates going down. Remember, the last time rates spooked everyone, rates went up. And so this is kind of the converse of that.
Well, I'll pick up on Jeff's last comment about, you know, the market's being spooked by, you know, this big sharp drop in rate. But I think, like, if you kind of peel the onion back, you know, another layer or two, I think the rates market is being spooked, you know, by relatively sort of sudden concerns about not just slowing growth, but after that jobs report for July, that was disappointing, kind of more asking the question, like, well, or have we underestimated just how much growth is slowing? Is a recession, now possible? Another point that Jeff mentioned, since last November, the bond market and all investors, frankly, have been waiting for the Fed to cut rates. It looks, after the Wednesday meeting on the FOMC last week, very likely that a September cut, is in the cards, and that the Fed kind of tipped their hand that as long as inflation doesn't really surprise the upside, it cuts coming. That's still, as of this recording, about 6 weeks away, which is not soon enough from the market's perspective. So it kind of raises the question, now what's the actual risk of the economy going into recession if we underestimated the slowdown? And is the Fed just too far behind the curve? They've waited too long to cut rates. And, therefore the risk of recession is going elevated or it's rising. That's kind of causing the rate move, but it's also causing kind of, markets, and other asset classes, to kind of spill over, not having all sorts of, implications for, this carry trade, with Japan, the yen, and other positions that were really kind of crowded based on a nice kind of relatively benign soft landing. Now that's kind of being called into question. So I guess my follow-up question for you, Jeff, would be based on those kind of two aspects. Rates have moved, but they've moved in part because of these rising concerns about just how much growth is slowing. And then also, is the Fed kind of now making a policy mistake by not cutting rates sooner? So my first question for you would be, what is your thought? Is, do you think is a recession now your base case for the next 6-12 months? Or if it isn't, what sort of probability, how do you think this is all shakes out for the U.S. economy, given all this kind of data that we've seen and what we kind of know as of this moment?
Yeah, I think, the Fed has been dancing around this too, because when I'm saying dancing around, I mean the rate cut, because effectively they don't want to cut rates. Somehow that lets asset prices go. You get stimulative behavior, then all of a sudden we get some sort of inflationary impulse there. And I think that's why they've been patient. That's why the mantra was higher for longer. And they figured, why not just give it 6 more weeks, right? It feels like an eternity sometimes, 6 weeks in markets. But I think that's the thinking. I think they're now in the cutting cycle. I think we get the cuts. We're going to see it. I'm not convinced we get the 50. We'll have to see. I think the data has to weaken between now and the Fed meeting. And I don't think, creating 100,000 plus jobs is going to, say that we need to cut 50 at this point. I did see one finance professor come out and say they should cut 75 immediately. It just shows how visceral these reaction functions really are. But I think the recessionary probabilities have been increasing as the summers went on. But I don't think anything's changed in my viewpoint in the last 3 trading days. Right. And so I think the labor market is becoming more imbalanced. You see that with the JOLTS openings, right? The job openings there. You see that with the unemployment rate went up, but the unemployment rate goes up. Remember, it's not on the non-farm payrolls. It's on the household survey. And so, again, I'm still on the fence whether or not, this is the divergence in those two reports that we've seen for the last 12 plus months. Is that driven by the immigration that's not being fully captured in the non-farm payroll, that's not being captured in the household survey. Sorry about that. That is what leads into the unemployment side. So I continue to watch unemployment claims. Yes, the trend has been up a little bit on initial claims, and the continuing claims continue to creep up. But I don't see some erosion in the labor market. So I'm not convinced the recession is imminent. So I would call that within the next 6 months. But I think the probability is still elevated for the next 12. Now, just because we don't see the recession, or I don't personally see the recession, doesn't mean it can't happen. But I think it's labor. And I think what you're seeing folks like Mary Daly come out, and I think she said either yesterday or early this morning, that just talking about you need to be proactive and make sure we're in front of this. And so I don't think the economy changes whether they cut 25 or 50. If they give us 75 or 100 the rest of the year, I don't think that changes the economic picture in the short term. And so I think we've already planted the seeds. We're going to reap what we sow there. And it doesn't seem like, again, looking at the retail sales data, looking at the consumption, it doesn't feel like we're at the recessionary tipping point. But again, we all know labor is the last shoe to drop there. And if we're starting to see significant more weakness, then that will elevate those probabilities. So from a standpoint of recession, I think we skate through the rest of this year. I'm going to continue to watch the underlying, consumption data. Obviously, the labor market is extremely important here. And I think both of those things are what are going to determine whether or not we kind of skirt this for a while, whether it is truly a soft landing. But it doesn't feel hard to me yet because the data hasn't weakened in such a manner that it looks like we need this emergency response from the Fed. I think the Fed will be patient. They'll give us guidance at Jackson Hole. I think they're going to tip their hand that it looks like the cuts are coming. But remember, the market already has roughly 50 basis points priced in for the next meeting.
Well, Jeff, I would share your view that I think recession risks, you know, certainly for the next 6 months, and I'd probably extend it out to the next year, are still relatively low, meaning like definitely below 50%. You know, maybe it's a 1 in 4 chance. And the way I kind of think of it ultimately is like the labor market and consumer spending, you know, are cooling. They have cooled. They'll probably continue to cool, but they're not going to crack. And you know, your comments about the labor market in terms of like how do we interpret, good job growth, like, 114,000 jobs last month, but like then the private sector non-farm payrolls is up 2.5 million over the last 12 months through the end of July. That doesn't seem like a, recessionary type of environment. The unemployment rate has simultaneously risen from the low, it was 3.4%, now to 4.3%, which has kind of triggered the SOM rule that has, been sort of identified as this, this be-all, end-all to some extent of a recession indicator. The way I kind of think about it is like when you, where to square the circle for the labor market is that, demand is certainly cool, but it hasn't faltered, but supply side has increased a lot. And that kind of can account for both good job growth, but also the rise in unemployment rate. And the demand for labor has moderated, but like just look at weekly initial jobless claims. They're still, you've ticked out, but they're still very low when you look at a historical perspective. When you adjust it for the size of the labor force, which is bigger than ever, they're very low. Right. So I think you have companies that are more cautious on hiring, but also really reluctant to fire. And it's a lagging indicator. And it's usually companies only lay off workers when their profits are declining, their margins are getting squeezed. And whether you look at S&P 500 companies or like national income accounts for overall profitability, it is, they're not rolling over in any significant way. So I think labor market holds up, that should support consumer spending. And if that's, then it becomes kind of a somewhat virtuous, kind of feedback loop. So it could be choppy headlines, but I think the overall picture to me doesn't warrant this. So then that kind of, and I agree with in terms of the Fed, like, we're now officially 50 basis points in September. I think it is data dependent. If August payrolls is 150,000, it's probably 25. To me, the key is whether the Fed really looks like they want to be proactive. So you mentioned Mary Day, like, are they proactive or not? If that's the economic view.
One thing on the other thing about the labor market too is that, one is Claudia said this too, that, it's a statistical property. It's not an economic forecasting of her analysis, right, of the SOM rule. But secondly, you point out NIPA profits. Also, the other thing, look at tax receipts, right? That's another good thing to look at as an indicator of earnings and being taxed on withholdings. And so if you look at tax receipts that came in the last month, very positive as well. So it doesn't look like that degradation's there. And apologies for cutting you off.
So I think we're kind of in agreement in terms of like, the subtle panic that's emerged about like could the economy tip into recession feels a little bit overdone along the lines of the market sort of sell off and rates declining very rapidly. So if we pivot from kind of the economic view being, still okay, it hasn't fundamentally changed in the past 5 days. When you look certainly on the fixed income landscape, maybe starting on rates, how do you view the rates kind of investment opportunity sets, given these moves? Do you think the 10-year, as an example, more likely to be at 4% or 4.25% or like 3.5% in the next couple of months? Do you think they drift higher? How much higher? Is the 2-year price out some of the cuts? Like, how would you think about the rates, the curve, the bull steepening, bear steepening? How does that, what's your thoughts on it for the next few months?
Yeah. Well, we've had the steepener on a bunch of our portfolios. We were fortunate. We did it about a year plus ago, and we bailed on the trade because it wasn't working. We didn't hold it very long because it's a negative carry trade. We put it back on a couple months ago, and we're fortunate to have that on. It's been a good area. I still kind of like it, but I don't love the absolute level of rates here. I think the 2 years should be more like 4%, unless like there really is this recessionary risk. I think it should probably be a little bit above it even. Maybe we get 150 basis points of cuts from the Fed, but I don't think you get them. It may take a year or so to get them. And then if we stay there, that kind of tells me 2-year looks roughly fairly priced. The 10-year, the question becomes is like, do we ultimately have this soft landing and a better economic environment? And if we do, maybe the curve is flattish to slightly upward sloping. And so maybe the 10-year should be a little bit higher. But then I come back to the overall kind of where we are in the economy with inflation, and whether I buy the 10-year today at 385 or I think it should be like a low four handle, doesn't really matter. Yeah, to a trader it does. But as investors and thinking about it, I'm getting positive real yield one way or the other, right? And if inflation's on its path to, let's say, the low to mid twos, which it sure looks like, that's the directionality of it, I think that, you know, that means that, you know, the bonds still give you some value. I think we're a little overbought very short term. Don't love it. We kind of try to get cute and take off a little bit of duration position yesterday. Nothing big, just kind of, traders want to trade. But at the end of it, I think that trying to distill this right now, I could easily see rates backing up a little bit, assuming the economic data doesn't weaken meaningfully. And look, we get inflation next week. That's going to be a key thing. It's likely to come down a little bit as well. Don't forget, you know, we're talking about the consumer and these other things and the labor market. But don't forget, too, that oil prices and gasoline prices, I know we have a little spike today with the Hezbollah news, but gasoline prices are down like 10%+ year over year. These things tend to help people out, in these kind of little pockets. So I think looking at it, is it a steepener? I still like it. But what's amazing is this has been a pretty parallel shift down in the curve. And so, although it was a little weird yesterday at the end, we had like long bond down where the rest of them were kind of up a little bit, or at least the back end of the curve was. And so it's really, we're looking for some direction here. You talked about credit spreads too. They blew out. It's just because, you know, look, IG spreads, like it looks like, wow, it's a horrible, horrible performance the last few days. But remember, the rate rally offset a lot of that. Not as much in high yield because it gapped out about probably 65-70 on spreads, so that hit it a little bit harder. But in general, you know, owning high-quality bonds hasn't been a bad trade still here, even in the credit spread. So looking at OAS last night, you know, we're talking like 110-ish. It's a little tighter today on IG, and I think it was just this knee-jerk reaction. But is it the knee-jerk reaction because of market behavior? I think that's what it is. Is it recession risk and it's a global meltdown? I don't think so. I think there's some offside positioning. I think there's a little bit of a, you know, kind of a squeeze on the short squeeze in the rates market because people are playing a little bit higher for longer, at least, you know, that the path is going to be subdued. And thus that set things off, which then ultimately, you know, kind of metastasized inside of the yen market, right? And so, you know, we see the big rebound there. I just don't think this is a panic moment at this point. And it's always these things when you have these big moves. Are we 20% way through the move? Are we 90% through it? And, after looking at trading today, it kind of feels like it's more than 90%. Cooler heads are prevailing a little bit today. And so, again, you said it best. In the last 5 days, the economic data hasn't changed materially. And I think it's just there's some nervousness on edge. And I think there's something that happened in the technicals in the market that kind of got that momentum going in a very short-term manner.
I want to go back to your comment about, you know, the 10-year, you know, yes, it could go up to, you know, in the low four handle range. And you also mentioned, like, you know, inflation is going lower, and so the real returns are attractive, and whether you buy it at 385 or 4.1, it may not make, from an investor perspective, may not make a huge difference because you're getting pretty good real yield. If we then abstract away from all the churn in the markets right now and think about the more fundamental picture, a concern that certainly existed, you know, in the rates markets, and it's, you know, oscillated just over the past, you know, 2 months, I'd say, is, you know, the prospect with the deficits being so large depends on the outcome of the election, like what that means for fiscal policy, but definitely concerns that if deficits keep running large, if inflation is, you know, stays on the sticky side, at least on the higher side of 2%, that the 10-year needs to price in more of a term premium. And, you know, this is a mythical number that's hard to quantify. You know, as we talk, I'm looking up on Bloomberg. There's an estimate that says it's minus 23 basis points. That, you know, it's kind of widely followed. How much do you think about that? Like, is the 10-year, like, long-term, it's just not pricing this, and therefore once you price in a proper risk premium or term premium, that really that the 10-year should be, you know, assuming it's all in, it should be like 4.5% or higher, given all these, you know, large deficits that, you know, it seems like it's, you know, for as long as we can relatively forecast, they're going to be really high. Is that pricing that in, or do you worry about that, you know, not being priced in, you know, into the 10-year?
Yeah, I think of the term premium more as like the long bond too, and the long bond's been a little more fickle during this move, and so I do, you know, we had the 230s uninvert, right? You know, where we had some inversion for a long period of time, right?
It uninverted for about 5 minutes, though. It was a long. It was just like poked its head out like the groundhog.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but that was 210. 230s is still uninverted at this point, right? Right? Because we had the two years, like roughly, like call it four, and then the long bond's like 415. So that one uninverted over the course of all this. So I kind of think of that. But secondly, if you're going to talk about term premium, I also think we got to get to terminal rate, right? And so terminal rate being like where the Fed, and our star is mythical as well with the whole neutrality. But I think you have to get to a level to say, okay, what is terminal? And then what does the term premium look like to that? So again, I think that's looking at too many forwards and it gets too complicated. But at the end of it, the long-term deficit is a big issue, and so far the bond market doesn't care about it. There was a lot of ink spilled in media last summer about it, trying to explain why rates went from, you know, like the 10-year went from like 330 to, you know, the high fours. It kissed five for a second. And at the time, it was all deficit, because there was nothing else to point to. If I'm not mistaken, Jason, I think the deficit today is worse than it was back then. Maybe not as a percentage of GDP, but we keep piling the debt on. And so I worry about this, but I think it's the thing to worry about, the kind of fiscal spending when it comes to the next recession and the response mechanism of our politicians during that cycle. And so some of that will have to do with the outcome of the elections in November, but also once we do hit the speed bump in the economy, what will be the appetite of our elected officials to help stimulate through that? And so, again, the last two episodes that we've had recessions in the U.S. Economy, it turned into massive, massive stimulus. And this time, or the most recent episode, the politicians went fast, so did the central bank. So the question becomes is, what does it look like? Are we going to, you know, inject $3-5 trillion into the economy to try to help salvage the recession? And so that, I think, is just an unknown. What it looks like, I think history tells us they'll probably do something, but what's the magnitude? And so I think some does ride on the election as well. I think if you got like a massive red Republican wave here, that, you know, there is a bigger risk to it simply because, you know, you'd have the coordination of the policy, you would have likely the tax cuts get extended, and on top of that, you have the risk of a President Trump electing some sort of official to, or putting somebody in charge of the Fed who wants to obey his policies and becomes Arthur Burns-esque. That, to me, is something you could envision, but I think that's a low likelihood of all three chambers going that direction, or at least the three parts of it. So ultimately, it's hard to get through the election right now, especially what was looking like it would be a pretty easy Trump victory now looks like a very contested election. And so we'll have to find out what that looks like. So again, I think regardless of that, we'll know November, but then if they don't come in until January, right? So there's still this time to prepare for it. So to me, you know, the deficits matter. The election matters, but I think both of those things you have some time with. And as you've seen in the last like 3 weeks, the market sentiment can move massively on its assessment of what's going on in the election very, very quickly.
You mentioned about to get a sense of like the term premium and the 10-year should be, you kind of have to say what is neutral in terms of like how much is the Fed cut. So like neutral is another concept that, you know, we can debate ad nauseum and never really know the answer to it, which means we both could be right, which is a nice debate to have. But a more practical question would be like, all right, so I think we both agree Fed's going to start cutting rates in September. How aggressive they are this year is going to be data dependent. It, you know, like we're in agreement that, you know, data is going to hold up. So whether it's 75 or 100 basis points of cuts this year, like not materially a huge difference. But what would you think between like, you know, now, end of next year into 2026, a realistic level, like where the Fed is going to cut? And again, assuming probably not a recession, at least, you know, or maybe a very mild one. Like, if they stop at 3.5%, that sort of justifies a 10-year in the 4-ish kind of range. Or do you think the AL we can will go back down to like what they're saying is like kind of a 2.5 to 3% range?
I think it's low to mid threes, and so I think they probably try to get to 3.5, and but it's always going to depend on how things materialize around it. But I think that's the rate they want to get to in the next, you know, call it 15 months, but in the next year, and I think that's where they're trying to get to, and you know, see how that works out. And if so, in that scenario, and inflation's contained, you know, look, the front of the curve still offers you value, right? I mean, look, you have real yields that are positive. Probably means the 2-year needs to go a little bit lower, but not meaningfully lower. And look, maybe the belly of the curve just kind of moderates where it is, right? Maybe it drifts up a little bit, as you're saying, maybe it's a 4% 10-year. But I think that as you look through it, and you're trying to. The problem is that the market got whipsawed, pricing all these cuts at the beginning of the year, and then rates had to back up. And when the 2-year backed up, they brought everything with it as well. And so I would expect it a little bit more of a steepening in this rally, we haven't seen it. You know, there has been some, but I would expect kind of you get to a 10-year to look closer to 2s, and again the rally, you know. We got the single-digit basis points in 2s, 10s, you know, on the close. As you mentioned briefly intraday, we went uninverted for a minute. But I do think that as you kind of think through this cycle, there's a lot of variables to play here. And so what I would try to say is don't get cute with it, right? Bonds worked in the last couple of days as the risk-off play. We've all been talking about valuation of other asset classes. And so what you've seen here is that kind of this idea that with yield levels where they were, there is the ability for them to rally, especially in a Pavlovian response to this perception of massive weakness. And so I think you've got to think through this about the overall allocation and what you're looking for in bonds. I know that, you know, we sit and look at the bond market day in, day out. Most investors do not. And I think it's important just to say, what can you do for your overall portfolio? And look, spreads got tight in credit. You know, we've been sitting on a little bit of cash for this reason. You know, we've been trying to buy bonds, you know, over the last day and a half, right? You know, in the credit areas, just let's do some of the nibbling we were talking about. You know, look, if spreads left 50 on high yield, let's take a little bit. So there are things to do throughout all this period versus just focus on the exact level of the interest rate. And again, I know it's our jobs to do that, but I don't want to miss the forest for the trees.
Well, so picking up on that point about nibbling for opportunities within kind of across fixed income, but you know, once you kind of get into more like the spread products, or like not just treasuries, what are things that you like? You know, corporate credit areas. I know we like and has to like, you know, agency MBS, you know, some of the securitized products because corporate credit was pretty tight. Is it now interesting? You know, opportunities overseas. Like, where are you? Where are you nibbling, and where are you going to take big bites, do you think? Or where would you want to take big bites?
I'm very anti-overseas at this point because I still think we have carry here in the U.S., and I'd rather own U.S.-centric assets at this point in the cycle, especially given that we're all dependent upon what the Fed is doing. And so the world is dependent on it. So I don't like the overseas markets at this point. You know, the agency MBS market is cheap. It's staying cheap. Even after this vol, it's kind of stayed here. The mortgage basis has been flat for the last month or so. The only thing is just what is current coupon now. It kind of moves around a little bit. But look, at 140 over is kind of the blended spread, not an OAS, but just kind of duration neutral spread on current coupon. It's very interesting. You know, that's something even in our credit portfolios, you know, like our flexible product that's on your platform, like we've added to that trade a little bit as a surrogate for some corporate bonds out there. And, you know, again, the spreads haven't really tightened in, but on the widening, it obviously has outperformed over the short term. And so we like that area. I still like shorter duration credit because a higher quality, shorter duration credit, because that has lower spread duration and thus less volatility. And that by nature, I like the securitized market. So we still like some of the CLO market. We still own a little bit of the higher quality bank loan trade, even with the forward curve repricing some of this, you know, these Fed cuts. I don't think it's a problem for spread widening of those bonds. Maybe your coupon will reset likely downward. So still like those kind of shorter kind of credit trades. Don't really love IG on the front end. It's too tight. I can get pickup elsewhere. But, you know, I don't have a problem with owning corporate bonds at these levels, you know, whether it's IG or high yield as well. You know, again, we've been underweight both of those in favor of the shorter part of the curve. And look, we've had a little bit longer duration in our treasury book to offset some of that. So I'm still in favor of a very balanced approach to the market. Again, we're a little underweight duration, but we have longer duration on the curve. So it's kind of worked in this environment. And then our spread duration has been shorter. So we haven't really gotten hit as bad as some of the other areas. And that's kind of been our playbook for a while. And again, given the macro outlook, it doesn't really change my view on that because the macro environment hasn't changed. It's just price levels have changed a little bit. So the thing we've been trying to do before the last week was to buy a little bit more of the CMBS market. There's been some widening there, especially in the single A, double A kind of shorter duration conduit space that has been pretty attractive, where spreads were out 50 or 60 before this move. They're about 100 out off the lows now today. And we were in the middle of trying to buy some of this stuff. And so we've been trying to accelerate a little bit of that program. And there's some technical pressures, a lot of supply coming because they're worried about the election in the CMBS market while the other parts aren't, at least the issuance calendar. So the playbook is very similar. And I still think structured offers the relative value. And, you know, it has been holding up over this. We'll have to see how things continue to play out. But, again, getting a yield advantage, having shorter spread duration, I still think it's the right playbook. The nibbling, want to buy a little bit at the margin, the high yield, but I still like the CMBS trade that gives me, you know, something that I think is pretty attractive as well with less credit risk.
We're nearing the end of our time together for today. 30 minutes goes very quick with such a lively and actionable discussion, though I do want to gather some final thoughts. So what we'll do, Jason, we'll provide Jeff, our guest, with the final word. I'll go to you with any final thoughts or takeaways you would like to leave our listeners.
Well, I'd emphasize kind of three things. One, a lot of market turbulence, but I think the fundamental story, in our view, has not really changed. We still think a soft landing, you know, next to 6 to 12 month horizon, that still is the right, you know, framework. That said, the next, you know, few months, maybe through the election, is going to be potentially quite choppy. We spent a lot of time talking about the economy and the Fed, but there are questions about the AI kind of, you know, thesis been driving equity markets, geopolitical tensions, elections, sort of uncertainty of how that could play out in terms of policy. So potential for more ongoing volatility for the next couple of months. And as a result, the general kind of recommendations across different asset classes we would have, it's a look for quality asset classes. It's probably not a time to get overly risky or cyclical, but also not, you know, defensive environment. I think we think that still will ultimately be, you know, a relatively favorable environment on like a medium-term horizon for financial markets.
I like that concept. I say for every unit of risk you buy, you should buy something to help offset it as well right now, just given that potential for the volatility there. And being up in quality doesn't mean you have to sacrifice meaningful yield today. There's good quality trades out there that still work. And I think ultimately for investors that are looking to position a fixed income portfolio, having balances, we are still tilted as a house to only a little bit more credit, but it's higher quality. It's shorter in spread duration, shorter in duration. And so it allows us to have some of those positions in things in the belly, like agency mortgages, like IG credit, and then have a little bit long on the treasury side, you know, called 7 to 10 year kind of position there, simply to help balance out some of those risks. And so I don't like to get caught up in the day-to-day trading. I recommend the same to you. And I think just having this idea that, hey, you can earn carry in the fixed income market. We can see how it can behave as a risk-off asset again. And I think that's the playbook over the next 6 months or so. And if you get some weakness in certain areas, you got to be willing to rotate. So I think that nothing has changed in my outlook in the last week. I just think that now we're pretty well wedded to Fed cuts, but remember the market has it priced. And so don't try to get cute here. Don't try to think that we have a lot more knowledge than anybody else out there on that. And I think it's just important to understand what you own. This isn't the time for severe risk taking, but if you're going to take it, try to offset those risks and do them unit for unit.
Well, Jeffrey Sherman of Double Line Capital, Jason Dreho from the UBS Chief Investment Office, thank you again for joining us on How Should I Be Positioned to share with our listeners, our clients, very timely insights into the market, the macro environment, covering monetary policy, sharing guidance when it comes to portfolio positioning. Very helpful during times like these. So thank you both again, and do look forward to at some point picking back up with our conversation again.
Thank you, Dan.
Yeah, always a pleasure.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliates. The views and opinions expressed in this material by external guest speakers are those of the author, speaker, and are not those of UBS, its subsidiaries, or affiliates. Accordingly, UBS does not accept any liability over the content of this material or any claims, losses, or damages arising from the use or reliance of all or any part thereof. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient, and is published for informational purposes only. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.